Hello, and welcome to Be the Serpent, a podcast of extremely deep literary merit, with your classy and sophisticated hosts, Alexandra Rowland, Freya Mask, and Jennifer Mace. On today's episode, we're joined by a special guest as we discuss A Deadly Education by Naomi Novik and Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone by J.K. Rowling.
Hello, and welcome to episode 71, Back to School. I'm Alex, and I'm the one who took too many arts and crafts classes, and now I have too many projects and even more regrets.
I'm Freya, and I'm the jock who's secretly topping the year in biology, but trying to hide it.
I'm Macy, and I am the mathlete who makes jocks cry for fun.
And I'm Naomi, the nerd who got locked in the library after hours and didn't notice.
We are three redheaded fantasy authors, joined today by a special guest.
A special guest. Hello, Naomi. Thank you so much for joining us. It's so wonderful to have you.
It's my pleasure to be here. And
Freya, who is this Naomi person that we have with us? I pretended like I know who she is, but I actually have no idea.
And I'm sure no longtime listeners of this podcast will have any idea who this person is, but we are absolutely delighted today to be joined by Naomi Novik, who is a fantasy writer of the Temeraire series, Uprooted, Spinning Silver, and the book we're going to be discussing today, and also a founder of the Organization of Transformative Works, which is very near and dear to our hearts.
Yes, I don't think you really gave me a chance to say, and today we're talking about, but today we're talking about some cool stuff. We are focusing today on magic schools and Naomi's wonderful book, which is just about to come out, right?
So soon.
Yes, September 29, I think, so I'm...
That's probably in the past, it's because we forget how time
we
works.
We do forget how time works. We generally have problems
with
time
just
on
come
this
out.
Podcast. It will have just come out.
Yes, excellent. It has just come out. Yes, we are leaping into the future. Yeah. It's like we are throwing our voices forward.
But before we get into all that, fellow serpents and Naomi, what are we reading lately?
I read the second book in K.J. Charles's Will Darling series, The Sugared Game, which is just, it's so delightful. Even more stabby, grumpy bookseller and aristocratic, nervy trash gremlin. I love this series. It was a wonderful escape. I had to then go back and reread some earlier K.J. Charles favorites while I was in the mood. I then took a complete 180 and read some Octavia Butler for the very first time. So I finally picked up Kindred, which is her book about a young black woman in the 1970s who finds herself being drawn back in time again and again to save the life of a plantation owner's son, who turns out to be one of her ancestors. It's obviously quite confronting reading. It's absolutely amazing. I'm definitely going to be picking up all of the other Butlers that have been sitting on my shelf unread. And surprising nobody, my yearly romp through Dorothy Dunnett has to this time continued into a book I've never read before. So I'm actually now making my way through the Niccolo series, and I just finished the second one.
How many hundreds of thousands of words of Dunnett are you going to have come out of 2020 having read, Freya?
All of them.
Many.
That is a guarantee. I did my Lyman reread earlier this year. I am now going to make my way through all 8 books of Niccolo.
God, why?
Freya. They're just so good, Macy.
There's no why.
Not to question why. Dunnett is just so... It is having a little bit of a detrimental effect on the word count of my current novel. I will have to admit that. I will have to go through and do an undunnetting edit.
But why? It'll be... Freya's current book is delightful and will only be more delightful with a little dunnetting.
Haha, you say that.
Macy, what are you reading?
Macy has been reading space books. So I've been continuing my reread of Freeport, and I found a space Wei Wuxian, like, resurrection fic that I've been reading, but I forgot to write it down, so heaven knows what it's called. I will leave that to the scribes. And I also read Provenance by Anne Leckie, which is set in the same universe as the Ancillary Justice trilogy, but is a totally different set of characters with way more, like, heisting and sibling rivalry, and they have a spacewalk that is super tense, and there's like a weird spidery, like, underwater alien thing. It's great. And also, yes, read way too much Scum Villain fanfic, which will be a theme, as you will find out, darling listeners.
Yes.
And I'm extremely mad about the fact that I have been gotten by a TV show called Motherland Fort Salem, which is a military academy, like rah-rah US supremacy show about like gender-flipped patriarchy and witches. And it's gay, and I'm mad that it got me because it's very like propaganda. I am not immune to propaganda, but it's gay, yeah. And I'm weak. So that's me.
Very good. Naomi?
So my daughter just hit the perfect age, and we mainlined Avatar, The Last Airbender. Nice. And have now moved into Korra, which is a little bit, you know, obviously it was perfect if you were watching Avatar over a 3-year period, right. And then grew up and then Korra comes out. It's a little bit ahead of her for now. So it's a little bit scary and creepy, but she actually is super into it and I'm really enjoying it. So that's really been quite delightful. I always get really slow on reading when I'm writing, and I've been writing a lot lately, just professional writing, and so I've actually just been creeping very slowly through a book that I actually normally would read in like a giant gulp because I'm really enjoying it. It's Beasts Made of Night by Tochio Onyebuchi.
Oh, nice.
Which is just I mean it's really it's hard to describe, but it's wonderful. So I highly recommend that.
Yeah, Tochi's work is fantastic. Highly recommend. I think I read Beasts Made of Night several years ago when it first came out, but for some reason I only remember the beginning of it. But yeah, it was fantastic. Highly recommend.
Yeah, just the sin eating.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just so amazing.
Just so good. So good. I have not been reading or watching very much this week. So I watched the first episode of the brand new animated show adaption of Scum Villain, and it is surprisingly incredible. Macy, what?
It's just very eerie. It looks like a video game.
It's extremely eerie. It's extremely eerie. It does look like a video game. It is completely CGI animated. And so, like, you look at the faces sometimes, and it hits me in, like, a real uncanny valley place for a lot of it, but there's these moments where they get the expressions absolutely flawless, and also it benefits because the voice acting is incredible. They got some really, really talented actors for it, and the pacing is exquisite. There was not a moment to breathe in the first episode. Highly recommend.
You're gonna make me watch this thing, aren't you?
You're going to have to. Yeah. It's actually really good.
Okay, fine.
And of course, I'm still reading loads of Scum Villain fanfic and The Untamed, as usual. So let's just jump right into the episode. Dear listeners, before we go any further, we do just want to let you know, as you know from the intro section that we already gave you at the beginning of the episode, we are going to be talking a little bit about the first Harry Potter book. J.K. Rowling is a TERF, and if you are not in a place where you are comfortable listening to this episode, totally fine. Come back to it another time, or just skip it. Please take care of yourselves and whatever you need to feel good about things, I guess. I don't know where I'm going with
where are you going, Alex?
I'm not sure.
Heads up, darling listeners, this is what the tentpole is.
Yep, pretty much just that. Sure. Thank you, Macy. Very concise.
And also, we will be talking a lot about a very exciting book that has only just come out. So if you want to go read that before listening to this episode, spoiler warning, dear listeners, for everything.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
But you should already have it on pre-order, right?
Absolutely, you should have it, having pre-ordered it. Yes, 1,000%. I think that we should try to not spoil it too much.
We will find out what Naomi chooses us to talk about.
Yeah,
that's true.
You know, I honestly, the thing is, actually, I have friends who are complete spoiler phobes. I myself am not a spoiler phobe. Partly that's because I forget things after I read them.
That's a mood.
To the point where I've read stories and been like, oh, this is quite a good story. I wonder, it's exactly to my taste. And then I go up who wrote it and it's like, oh, it's me. I've literally had that happen to me.
Okay, who is in charge of Harry Potter? Because we forgot to pick a person.
Sure. I will be in charge of Harry
Go,
Potter.
Freya! You just volunteered! Well done!
All right. So, as we said, our first tentpole this week is Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone, inexplicably marketed under a different title in other countries. Oh, thank you. Macy is now holding...
Because philosophers are boring.
I just read a scene in which Hermione was hiding in the quote-unquote girl's bathroom, and I had to put the book down for a moment and calm down, because that's not the...
Anyway.
Fine, Americans, fine.
Once Macy has finished with her transatlantic tantrum...
Yeah. Never! Never, Freya! You've learned this. Freya, what is this book?
This book, if you have been living under a small cultural rock... is the first book in the Harry Potter series. It is the introduction for, I guess, most of our generation, I would say. It's a very foundational magic school book. And it introduces us to Harry Potter and his friends and enemies and various people who will be important in his magical education and his life. Obviously, it is stuffed full of boarding school tropes and all the world building in the world, but... it also tells a very self-contained story that introduces us to the idea of Voldemort as an evil that has now left the world and is coming back into it and has a personal tie to Harry Potter himself. I don't think we need very to good. Go into further detail. I'm almost certain you've either read it or watched the movie.
Yes, yeah. Apart from... I have a mild American freakout from Alex scheduled.
Yes, which is someone wrote in the document here about how it comes from boarding school tropes. I remember being like, I think I was like probably 18 or 19 years old and finding out that like houses are actually a thing in British boarding schools and being like shocked to my core because I genuinely thought that was just a Hogwarts thing.
Well, Freya was in a house,
I was in
right?
two houses. They're a thing in primary schools in Australia, like public primary schools. And yeah. then they're a big thing at my high school, which was a private Anglican girls' school. So, house
spirit. But did you get sorted into your houses by a hat?
Well, kind of. I was sorted by a primogeniture because my mother was in my house when she was at my school, which is possibly even more English.
Yeah.
Yes. That's, yes.
I nearly got sent to a boarding school in York for a while there, but my mother had a class tantrum and refused to
God,
let me go.
God, think of the funny stories you would have if you'd gone to boarding school in York.
I know.
Anyway.
Anyway, we have more books and more interesting new books to talk about.
Naomi, please regale us with everything about your book.
All right, so it's called A Deadly Education, but actually in my head, all three of these books, it's a trilogy. All three of them are really just the Scholomonts.
Yep.
And so the Scholomonts is this legend that appears, it's mentioned in Dracula. Bram Stoker got it out of a book about Eastern European folklore. And it's essentially this legend of a school where the devil takes the hindmost. And the idea is that it was this school of dark magic and wizards would voluntarily go into this school knowing that at the end of 10 years or something like that, they would come out with just heaps of wonderful magical power, but the devil would take the last one out the door and claim their soul.
Nice.
And so I actually learned this legend completely from, and I'm sorry, this visual aid will not be available to those just reading it, but I have it here to show.
So, darling listeners, this book is like three times the size of your head.
Oh, it's,
this is a huge book.
Gorgeous.
Yes, it's a gigantic, this is from the Time Life series of books advertised on TV. you could get them for the low, low subscription price of, I think, $12.99 a month. And a new volume of this, I think, like 38 book series would appear at your door every day.
Amazing.
If you only subscribed by calling the 1-800
Incredible.
When your parents were already asleep.
So which one is this?
Which I did not do. This one is Wizards and Witches.
Ah.
And there is literally a two-page spread in here, which I will now attempt to find.
It's illustrated.
Oh yes, no. I mean, this is basically it's a thin excuse for putting in public domain art collecting in and filling up lots of pages and then selling your book to people who order it on late at night television. on television. But anyway, so this was the spread, and you see this room, it's pitch black.
Oh, yeah.
And there's just these handful of hooded figures visible in it. And the thing about this was this, the school has no teachers. The wizards would ask questions, and the answers to their questions would appear in letters of flame.
Amazing.
And so this idea of this school sort of lodged itself in my 10-year-old brain and stayed there. And there was a point, I've gone through like more than one cycle of writing Harry Potter fanfic. I go through fandoms fairly quickly, at a quick pace, but occasionally I come back to one after a gap. And Harry Potter was one of the ones that I came and back to after quite a long gap. But in my first round through, which was I think around 2000, I wrote a set of sort of Scholomance, a story where Draco ends up inside the Scholomance. And I sort of refined my ideas of the school and played with that idea. And then that was, 20 years ago. That was it. That was it. But one of the key pieces of that story that I kind of, that stuck with me is, why do you choose to go into a school like this? What kind of a person chooses? What are the things that could make you go into a school like this? And the necessary sort of despair that has to be behind it. And so that was sort of living in my head for a long time. And then later on, I came back to Harry Potter, I think in like 2016, 2015.
What is time?
Yeah. And I basically kind of sort of got engaged with the idea, which didn't actually show up in any of my Harry Potter stories at the time. But one of the questions that sort of lodged back in my head as I returned to Harry Potter was sort of that magic is free. Or rather, the ways in which the economy of Harry Potter does not actually make sense because magic is free.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So the Weasleys, who have a total of 8 highly skilled wizards in their family, should not be poorer than the Malfoys, who only have 3, right? No. That's completely makes no sense. But you know, we're still supposed. So what's going on? And there's a lot of ways in which the signifiers in Harry Potter are kind of confused in that, you know, I my personal take actually is that Harry Potter is a story about a mother who wants to buy things for her child, a mother who wants to provide for her child. And obviously that feeling is informed by knowing what Rowling was going through as she came up with the story. But it very vividly throughout feels to me, you know, like the things that are so rich, so vibrant are the shopping, right?
Yes.
The
shopping. That's my favorite part too.
And if you've ever been to like the Wizarding World in Orlando, that's what makes it so wonderful. It's not the rides. The rides are kind of like, okay, but it's literally getting to be in these magical stores.
You
physically feel yourself in this world, which is sort of magical and yet consumerism. Yay!
Well, it's the fantasy. The fantasy moment, the big moment for Harry Potter in the first book, because we were rereading it for this, is that moment on the train where he buys one of everything off the cart.
Yes.
Yes.
Because for the first time, he can afford to eat.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Even more so than because, the moment that he goes into Diagon Alley, right, like, that is a moment of, like, wonder of, like, oh, wow, there's this whole world that I didn't know about. But I would completely agree, Macy, you're right, because, like, the moment where he has access to it is the moment on the train.
I think that what you're getting at, right, because that's the thing that really came across to me in A Deadly Education, was the strength of what the mother was trying to do for Elle.
Mm. Yeah, and, but the in a way, it's sort of, the piece that kind of that kind of falls to the wayside in Harry Potter for me is that that's because that's the story that she wants to tell. She doesn't really care about the economy. She cares about that visceral kind of experience, right? That joy. And so the economy does not kind of make sense. It's really just, you know, she's just giving us the pleasure of being able to buy things, you know, of your kid having money, of imagining right. your child being able to get everything, that, right? So that was one of the seeds of leading me into A Deadly Education eventually. Mm-hmm. And then it's sort of bumped into the state of the world. climate change. And as the mother of a child myself, in a way, thinking about the things that I want to give and how it's not the material. And yeah, and so those are the sort of the stew that was in there and what came out when I sit down to write, because I don't ever actually have a plan when I write. Yeah. I just sort of sit down and the sentences start to come. And in this case, the first sentence was this girl who wanted to kill the hell out of Ryan Lake. and I didn't know who she was. I didn't know who he was. I didn't, you know, it was just literally like I knew he had to die. That's what she told me.
Look, we've touched on a whole lot of things that I think I've already got points that we want to talk about. But I have to say, I love that you started with the legend of the last person in a cohort dies and went to how about 75% of every cohort dies?
Yeah. Yes. Well, let's talk about that. Let's talk about the purpose and nature of a magical education, right? And what is education for?
And so obviously in A Deadly Education, in the Scholomance, so that question that I had to answer, why do you go to this school? And the school that is so horrible, that exacts such a horrible price. And the answer clearly is it's better than staying outside.
Sure. Yeah.
Right? And because it's not just why do you choose to go, system? Like one individual.
Yeah.
Why do people send their children here? And obviously that has to be because systematically it has to be way better. And that's where I got the idea of, you know, it's your odds of making it out of puberty alive on the outside are 1 in 20. Right. The odds of making it out alive on the inside are 1 in 4.
This is great odds.
But of course... Yeah. And so you take the 1 in 4 odds, but that doesn't mean you are happy.
Right.
And it doesn't mean, and in a way, obviously, that becomes over time more complicated, that story complicates by that the odds aren't actually 1 in 4 for everyone there. And the odds, just like the odds are not actually 1 in 20 for everybody on the outside. And the ways in which it's all a very... It's a machine of exploitation, essentially, right? While it is also a place of shelter.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, because I think that if we're looking at magical educations and magical schools overall, like the pattern across various works, Harry Potter is also a story about class. In a very, very British way, it's all about class.
Extremely, yes.
Anybody who in the fanfic world tries to make some sense of the economy and the numbers and the population numbers... tends to imagine, you know, is Hogwarts really the only school? Because Hogwarts is a British public school, right? It is the fancy upper class, upper crust, uniforms for everyone and prefects with sticks. You know, it's Smeltings.
Yeah.
So who goes to the high school down the road? And then you look at something like, I will claim that Tamora Pierce's Tortle books have a magic school in them. Right. So Caladri of Mindelin goes to magical night school, even though it's not all that magical. And again, it's like secondary education is a thing for the privileged.
But
is magical education only a thing for the privileged?
And it's about what is this magical education actually meant to be preparing you for? Because in Harry Potter, it just seems to be everybody goes to school in order to learn how to use the magic that they have to fit into the magical society that they will be part of when they leave. One of my favorite things about reading Scholomance was that there's this balance between learning something that might be useful to you on the outside if you get out and learning something that will let you get through the final graduation exam, which is trying not to be killed by deadly monsters and horrible spirits. And so there's this big, when Elle is trying to learn things, there's this tension between, will this help me survive? Will this help me in the economy by getting something from somebody else that might then help me to survive, or will this be something that I can actually use on the other side? And only certain people of a certain level of privilege can afford to tip that balance into what will help me on the other side, because they have the assumption of getting out.
You mentioned graduation, and I just wanted to say, like, that was a thing that was making me laugh the whole way through the book, because, like, there's this vibe of, if you, dear listeners, if you've ever listened to Welcome to Night Vale,
yes.
Specifically the episode where Cecil is like, it's street cleaning day, run, yes. run, that's exactly what it's like.
But I also wanted to yes. say, part of the, yes. the models of education that are in Harry Potter, in Hogwarts versus the Scholomance, it's very much, here are your professors, they are the repository of wisdom, they will tell you things. It is, things are being passed down, and there's a few jokes about the stasis of knowledge, like Professor Binns has never changed his lectures in hundreds of years. Right. Whereas the Scholomance, you are trying to learn things that you might be able to learn on the outside, but there's also this sense that knowledge is something that is there to be discovered and rediscovered. Like you can access right. texts that may have been lost, or you can access knowledge right. that nobody on the outside currently has. And that will be something that you can then take out into the world if you get through graduation. And look, I am not a computer person in the same way that I know Naomi and Macy are, but even I picked up on the theme of how do I form this query to get information out of a formless void of possible data.
SQL is hard, okay?
Yes.
It's fucking like
many hours of debugging. Oh,
yeah, yeah, I feel like there must be some formative experiences that led to the idea of no matter what you ask the void, you get mass destruction.
But I do think we all, right, can agree we've all had the experience of trying to Google to try to find, like, the fanfic story yep. or the reference piece of material to write the story. And you're like, well, how do I ask to find the right kind of gun for use by, you know, the Stargate crew?
Yep.
Right.
Without getting put on a government list of some sort.
Right. Yeah.
When we started this podcast, Naomi, we had a few early scribes who would, like, hear me say something stupid, like the one Naruto fanfic with the levels of hell. And then they would just pop up with the link. And I'm like, how?
How are you doing this?
Like, they haven't read it. They didn't recognize the
Google
story.
Google wizards.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Alex, I want to draw in this dot point here now, because you said, is the Archive of Our Own a magical school for writers? Macy said that.
That was Macy.
And Alex added some things about speaking into the void.
I approve. I actually...
So in that case, what is the AO3 equivalent of a predilection for mass destruction spells when it comes to trying to search for things within the tags?
I was actually going to say that I feel like the Archive of Our Own is like a house, actually, right? I feel like Wattpad, fanfiction.net, Archive of Our Own, these are houses of magical education in the school of fandom.
The old school GeoCities
like 5 years ago. I think that was true 5 years ago, but like nowadays, particularly with like the import stuff, I remember going looking for Freeport back in the day when it was only on the Gundam Wing Raygun Works archive, and you had to manually copy paste every single page into a document and like save it as a Word doc, and it was a thing. But then I went searching a couple of years back and someone had imported it into the archive, and I'm like, yes, I can download a MOBI. It's 220,000 words long and I can read it.
Truly, we are living in such luxury these days.
But okay, I think if you have... So, darling listeners, in the book, one of the really fun things about L is that the school kind of has opinions about what it'll give you based on your predilections and talents. And L's talent is for mass destruction, and L would really it rather yes. wasn't. So whenever L runs a search query, she gets like obscure Egyptian curses and stuff. And I feel like on the AO3, this is getting tentacle porn every time.
Untagged.
You know?
Yes.
Untagged tentacle porn keeps turning up.
Untagged main character death. Untagged main character vore.
Yep.
So a school is an object for turning smaller humans than you into what you want them to be.
Yes.
And the you in this sentence is whoever is quote unquote paying for the school. So in our modern society, that's generally governments, and you see this based on the history curriculum in various countries. For example, I did not learn anything about the starvation in India in my British public schools. And I wonder why. You learned very little about Emmett Till in your public American high school.
Well, yeah, I was homeschooled,
and the only thing
we
learn about, like, the only thing you learn about the Native Americans is, like, you know, Thanksgiving! Everybody has a party!
Yeah, like, you would almost think that JK had gone to an American school for the accuracy with which she portrayed them. But so Scholomance, the goal is to keep people alive.
Yes.
In Hogwarts, the goal is to make you, quote unquote, a productive member of upper class society. What are some other magic schools? And how
a product do you I don't know that I feel like productive feels like a stretch for Hogwarts, right? It's where like
I'm giving the like Minister Fudge voice on that.
Yes.
So for many of the students who are going to Hogwarts, it's like going back to how British it is, right? It's an opportunity to do like 7 years of social networking. Yeah. Because
I mean, it feels like it's your only chance to meet your life.
Right, because like part of being a productive member of upper class society is like marrying someone who is also a wizard and then producing more wizards.
Yes, machines, very important. I will then, if none of you will take up my dot point that I put here, let's talk about. So Naomi, have you come across The Untamed in recent memory?
I have not. I mean, I've seen it like through fetish osmosis enough to be like, when I have time in some halcyon magical future.
Well, then please forgive us a like 3 minute aside because.
That's okay. Please do. It clearly looks like it's absolute. I'm sort of like, I want
to. Yes, it's so much fun. But the middle section, it's hilariously structured. The structure is nonsense. It's great. The middle section has two separate magical schools in it, I will argue. Yes. Lan Chi Ren's Gusu Lan indoctrination ceremony has a particular bent. Like, that is a magical school in which Lan Chi Ren wants to create a bunch of obedient small children who will follow the precepts of the Gusu Lan.
Yeah. So we are going to solemnly recite the precepts for you, all 3,000 of them, and you will take them in and you will obey them and be good little students, very quiet, very well behaved, versus the Wen indoctrination a little bit later on. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, come on, we need to have more magical schools than this. People, give me some input.
So there's, in Tamora Pierce's Circle of Magic, there is a, like, very established magical school, and then there is sort of, like, the little cottage run by the lesbians just outside the magical school, which is where the troublemakers get sent.
Yep.
And
lesbians
don't
help with that. They're very competent.
Well, there's also, there's also, of course, the Isle of Roke in Earthsea, right? Which is quite an early school of magic. And then by contrast, I would say one of my own quite vivid contrast is The Forgotten Beasts of Eld.
Oh, yes.
Which is about a wizard who is self-taught in a way. Like, her father is a wizard, and he teaches her, and she learns. But it's so personal. Her magic is so specific to the creatures.
Yeah. Well, you saying that makes me want to ask, is Uprooted a magic school story?
In a way. I mean, there is a magic school in it.
But I mean, even
right?
Just like
there's a school for wizards.
The dragon and her in the tower.
And the dragon, the dragon takes her in the tower and she learns magic. And it's just a sort of one-on-one, it's, you know, private, independent study. One-on-one tutoring with your very cranky
Well, what you said about the idea of personalized magic reveals another difference, I think, between the Scholomance and Hogwarts, is that Hogwarts has a structured curriculum that everyone does. Everybody does first year potions and first year transfigurations, and there are standardized tests at the end of it that everybody has to do. And there's a sense that some people are more or less gifted in different areas, and you can start to choose your electives once you get into higher areas, which is more or less how my high school worked as well. But the Scholomance is very much about self-directed learning and taking advantage of your particular strengths and areas of interests, or attempting to suppress them if you are ill and trying not to wreak mass destruction on a daily basis. But it's much more about it's a different model of education. It's saying we're not trying to produce a lot of witches and wizards who know the same spells and do the same things, even if they have different roles in their society, as this one's going to be a healer and this one's going to be an aura. It's saying magic is a lot weirder and more idiosyncratic than we think it is. And so the Scholomance is designed to say you can achieve almost anything if you put in the work and make the right sacrifices, and what you do will be completely different to what the person in the room next to you does, which I really liked.
Yeah, and and the part of that is, of course, that everybody is desperately trying to find their niche, the niche that will get them out the door. And the other piece is that, you know, I think that part of it is my sense that there's a lot of, in the U.S. at least, that there's a strong feeling that education has become kind of like a holding pen that keeps growing, right? So first you had to go through, you had to have a high school degree, then you had to have a bachelor's degree, right? And it's, in a way, it's a way to keep the labor force from growing too fast, which, and then producing people who are going, and it rewards people who can fit in, who can make themselves cogs in the machine.
I was just going to say, like, because it behooves a government to have uniform.
Industrialized. Right?
It behooves a government to have a uniform output of the school system. But.
Yeah. And the other piece, right, which I would add, is that in the US, there's a much stronger feeling that the purpose of the schools is to provide useful, not just useful citizens. Right, which is in some ways a little more innocent. It's useful labor,
useful factory
useful
parts.
Workers to business,
obedient. Let me clarify, rather than useful, obedient.
Obedient, yes, but it's producing interchangeable parts. Right. Where you can be like plopped into a setting and you can be exploited all day until you fall down dead on the job, and then you can be replaced with someone else.
But it's hilarious because what you actually see when you get out into the world among, you know, the scrabbling 20-something millennials, is everybody trying to stand out. Everybody trying to find, like you're saying, Naomi, their niche. Mm-hmm. Their, you know, what can I sell on Etsy? Yep. What can I hustle? What can I do that will set me somewhere unique so that I can't be replaced?
So let's talk about that, because I want to talk about the idea of interpersonal relationships in both of these texts. So one of the first things that Harry hears when he's being exposed to other wizards is, you don't want to go making friends with the wrong sort.
With the wrong sort.
Said to him by a small, pointy-nosed blonde boy who is being fitted for his robes. And for all that Hogwarts is a very, very class system, it's sort of giving you your niche on day one. It says, here, you're a smart person. Here's smart person table. Here is dubiously evil table. Off you go. and the idea is that...
You're 11.
The most generous interpretation of the house system is that it is trying to give you a friendship group from day one. The actual reason is it's trying to give you, exactly as you said, Alex, your professional network of, here are your people. You will come out of school knowing the right people and not the wrong people. And obviously, Harry Potter as a person forms friendships, like real friendships within both his house and to a certain extent outside of his house, but really he just goes along with making friends with the other brave kids in Brave House. Whereas the Scholomance, you have niches and cliques and friendship groups like any school would, but there's always a sense, and I think in this sense, Elle, the narrator, is a little bit of a biased narrator because she thinks purely in terms of allyship, not friendship. Who are my possible allies? Who can I work with, whose cog fits into mine in an interesting way for us to get through this alive? And there is an economics of favors and barter, and Elle just views everything in terms of that. Human feelings, sounds fake, not real.
There's also a sense from, and I think this does span more than just Elle, but perhaps not everyone in the Scholomance, that exerting yourself in any way has a cost and must extrude a value. Mm. And so why would I bother to go out of my way to make friends if I was not getting something out of this? That's something only the rich kids
and the psychology of someone doing you a favor, I think, is a lot more realistic in the Scholomance. Elle hates that Orion keeps saving her life. She does not want to owe this person anything. Whereas there is a sentence in Philosopher's Stone, which is, oh, after Harry and Ron saved Hermione from the troll in the bathrooms, they had to be friends.
They were inevitably friends.
I'm like, are you sure? That doesn't sound inevitable to me.
And I was having some really big thoughts about, like, the area of effect protagonist aura, which Harry definitely has, and it's not really questioned, but then...
But we're in Harry a little bit more than we're in...
Right, because like the entire thing is from Harry's perspective. He is the protagonist, and also he is exuding this protagonist aura. And so things just sort of happen to him. This happens in like many, many fantasy books where the protagonist just has a slightly easier... where the protagonist just has a slightly easier time of it than everybody else around them. And then you get books like A Deadly Education.
Which I don't understand. Right. No. The protagonist should always have the worst time.
Yes, where you have like everyone else at Hogwarts is like just trying to... Have you ever seen seen that webcomic?
Oh, the background. Life is a background Hufflepuff. Background Slytherin.
Yeah. Life is a background Slytherin. That's what it is. Where, like, there's right. this protagonist sort of, like, on the other side of the room, like, doing protagonist things. And you're like, I just want to get my homework done. God damn
yep.
it.
Yep. I just want to not get eaten by a monster. Could you stop attacking monsters when you're walking next to me, please?
Right. Right. And so, like, this happens to Harry.
Will you stop fighting the chimera in the alchemy lab? I'm trying to get my project done.
God damn it.
So, right. Darling, so, like, Harry... I've forgotten to tell you that that Alex is talking mostly about the second main character in The Deadly Education, who is
Orion Lake. Yes. who is very much, I think, positioned against Harry Potter in the conversation that A Deadly Education is explicitly having with Harry Potter about what it means to be a protagonist. Because you go into this school and, like, a chair could be trying to kill you. But Orion Lake just, like, and so everyone in the school is like, gotta check the chair before I sit down. Gotta check this box before I open it. Something could jump out and kill me. And Orion Lake is just, like, happily going around, sitting on chairs, opening boxes without thinking about it, because he has such a strong protagonist aura that it, like, affects the entire area around him. Yeah. And things just don't happen to him, right?
I mean, they do, but then he kills them.
But then he kills them.
Right.
And so he's, like, wandering around being this, like, slightly antisocial weirdo.
Well, I wasn't sure. I will ask Naomi this, because I wasn't sure if that was an Orion Lake thing or a fancy kid with lots of magical energy that none of the monsters were going to target thing.
Could be both.
You have to wait till book three.
Oh, okay.
Spoilers.
All right.
Okay. Spoilers.
I know, but no, I'm not telling. Yeah.
But the glory of having Elle as a narrator is that you have what everyone on the outside is probably thinking about this really annoying protagonist, and what a lot of people are probably thinking about Harry Potter, who breaks a lot of rules and still gets a bazillion house points for it.
He got given a broom for risking his life and disobeying a teacher? What?
And this invisibility cloak just turns up out
Everything
of the blue.
That happens to Harry is so unfair.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you can tell that there probably are some people in Hogwarts on the edges in his year who are having a very L time of it.
Oh, yeah.
And would like to just get through their homework.
Draco, for example. Yeah. Oh.
Yeah. And the thing, of course, is, right, that, you know, of course, if you sort of talk to Harry and were like, well, what would you rather have? A nice, normal life with your actual parents? Or would you like all this stuff? And he'd be like, can I have my parents?
Please.
Right. Please. As any rational, right? And, you know, obviously to me, that's the key for Orion, right? That was the key that I needed to make Orion matter to me, which is that he is choosing to save people.
Yeah.
Right? He doesn't have to. He could literally just be sort of sailing right through, no problems. And yet he is choosing to aggressively save people, even though he doesn't necessarily, at the beginning at least, have any reason to believe that he's going to be able to do this just fine, but he still is doing it. And that's obviously, I think, you know, part of what makes Galadriel so mad. That he's actually...
Well, I think the thing that really got to me was how upset he was when he didn't save Jack, right? Like, and how Jack's victim died. Like, it's clear that Orion isn't just trying to save people, but he's feeling it deeply when he fails to.
Mm. Yeah.
And I do like that you get more and more of a sense of him as Elle gets more and more of a sense of him. Because at the beginning, she sees he can afford to save people because, you know, philanthropy is a privilege when you are fighting for your life. And how dare he save everybody at me?
Yep.
You know, he's doing this to annoy me because he knows I haven't got all of the advantages that he has. And very slowly we see how her sense of who Orion is and what's actually motivating him and how he is a slightly more complicated person than that changes throughout the book, which is absolutely lovely.
But I want, because we've only got 15 minutes left, to talk about building.
Tell us about buildings, Macy.
Tell us, who wrote this? Who wrote the controlled farming of delicious children? Freya Mask, justify yourself.
Well, I was thinking about why in hell Hogwarts and the Scholomance were built. And so, yes, Hogwarts was built by the founders as a school of learning / social division and networking thing where we put a hat on and we produce a horde of children in our own image.
Yep.
Whereas the Scholomance, as Naomi said, was built specifically as a way of saying, well, we're going to lose a certain percentage of all of our young magic users anyway. This way, we'll just feed a very small amount of them to the monsters, and therefore, it won't be like overfishing. You know, we're not just letting everybody out there to thin the population.
It's sustainable.
It's because it's sustainable farming of delicious, magical children.
Right. Naomi, and you know, obviously, the thing is, right? So one of the things that, and this comes, this gets played with a little more, obviously, in book two and then in book three, which is, you know, sometimes the motives that you claim, right? There's the motives you claim publicly, and then there's the motives that you have privately, mm-hmm. and sometimes the two of them are not. You know, the public motive may not necessarily be a complete lie, even if you have the ulterior motive. And sometimes, of course, the forward motive becomes the real motive to the people who are after you. Or the background motive becomes the motive. You know, it's sort of that play of cynicism and idealism. Which motive do you choose to foreground as a person living in this system? Right. And that that tension is something that I feel very strongly in a lot of just sort of in general, right, in public life, right, that we have that and in schools. And that's a thing that it feels very true to me that, you know, and so the motives for the building of the Scholomance, I think, are a little murky. Yeah. In a way that it can be experienced, as I do think, right, so many of us, which of us, right, doesn't know somebody who literally went to the same school that we did, had possibly almost exactly the same class as we did, and yet had a completely different experience, mm-hmm. right, whether vastly more positive, vastly more negative, and looks back on it in a completely different way. And that's something that I think is important, right? It's a magic school. It should not be like a single monolithic experience. Mm. Yeah.
And the whole point of the plot of the first Harry Potter book is that a school that was built to be a very safe and well-guarded place is now being used to guard something completely different.
Right.
And without telling the children about it. We've just put this magical item there. We've guarded it with a whole lot of very dangerous spells.
Which is also book two.
Just don't wander into that. Just don't wander over there as if that's ever worked on a child in ever.
It's also book two with the fucking basilisk. Book three with the let me hire a werewolf.
Yeah. And it's a school that says, this is a safe place to send your children. You know, we will protect. Yeah. We will protect really? Them. Right. Whereas the Scholomance says this is not a safe place to send your children, but it's the best chance they've got.
But you're making me think, Freya, a little bit about the interaction between that, which isn't really very voiced in canon. Like nobody notices that and calls it out, and a lot of the fanfic, which comes back to Hogwarts almost as a holy place, and then is like, this has been despoiled. Let us fix it up. I'm thinking back again of Transfigurations, right? Mm.
But I mean, across the Harry Potter series, the importance of Hogwarts as shelter becomes more and more and more important. Like it's the idea that you can't, transport yourself into it. It's a place that is there essentially as a narrative device to shelter Harry while he grows up into somebody who can kill Voldemort.
Well, specifically, yes, it's a shelter for the abused child. From Harry's point of view, Hogwarts with its basilisks and werewolves is safer.
Yes,
and
I mean it's a shelter, right? If you're escaping domestic violence, right? It's the place that you go, and of course, but at the same and yet it's also meant to be a place of adventure, and so you know places of adventure are not very safe. Not
but
safe.
I think that we tend to anthropomorphize Hogwarts a lot, and Hogwarts itself helps with that. But I think that a lot of magic schools do take place in kind of semi-sapient buildings. Like the Scholomance definitely felt like it had opinions.
Mm. And if it doesn't, the Void definitely does.
Well, and I do also feel that, you know, magic, right? Magic is something that should spill over. Right? You know, that's where the Maleficaria, really, a lot of the Maleficaria are the consequences of wizards using magic and not really kind of keeping control of it. And that things that you create and give certain kinds of will to will eventually kind of take on a will of their own. And in a way, they're algorithms,
yes.
Right? They're the social media algorithms. You let them loose, and they'll try to eat you.
But it made me think a little bit, like a lot of the males made me think of the bit in House Proud, right? With the bed mm-hmm. and the thing coming out from underneath.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, it's about what you get. Yes. You get back what you put in. And after a certain point, if you put in neglect and if you put in horror and fear, that's what you get back out. And I love the idea of the Maleficaria as the social media algorithm because, we don't know how to protect children from what the internet has become after years and years and years of thoughtless output.
I mean, YouTube is terrifying. Yeah. The ways in which it's radicalizing people purely based on an algorithm that's designed to optimize for engagement without really sitting back and thinking, what does engagement mean for our monkey brains? Like, what is engaging?
Yeah.
Well, shocking and horrifying things and conspiracies that are false are, surprise, engaging.
Right, right. Things that could not be real, things that are lies. Lies are much more engaging than the fairly prosaic everyday.
Because it's exciting.
Speaking as a writer of lies, who is nevertheless trying to tell the truth.
Yeah.
But I do feel like I do feel that the school comes to life. That there is a life, there should be a life in the stones.
Well, and it made me compare it a little bit to the space school in Ender's Game, which is kind of the very far sci-fi end of magic schools, right? But you definitely feel that there's kind of so many kids living in such fear and tension that it kind of seeps into the environment. And you do feel like this, the dragon's dorm is different to whatever the other kids' teams' dorms were. It's interesting because kids anthropomorphize.
At a certain point, the culture of the school becomes the school itself.
Mm.
And it's about what kind of culture is being cultivated.
And I mean, especially in Scholomance, because like explicitly the thing that you believe is what becomes true, right? And like if you believe, like the school is partially powered by your belief in the school.
Right.
Yep.
Right. And you know, so it's important because obviously that's why they have the blueprints all over the walls that they have. Yes,
but can I just engineer nerd out because I really love the stuff about like patching patches on top of patches and like fixing the school and the way that mutated what it was meant to be. And I'm just like, yes, this is how engineering works.
It's definitely an engineering thing, but it's also an education thing. It's about saying this is how we've always taught it. Oh, we better make some tweaks to the curriculum. Just to reflect what's already happened, but at a certain point, you may need to go in and completely revamp from the roots. But nobody's doing that.
Right.
You haven't got time, so we just keep patching and patching.
This is fine.
Right.
Yeah. So we have a little bit of time left, and I really wanted to talk about Omalas.
Well, when don't we want to talk about Omalas, frankly? This whole podcast was founded on Omalas.
An entire episode about Omalas.
The reason that we started this podcast, Naomi, was because we wanted to yell about Omalas and Victory Condition.
Yes.
Yay.
Because nerds. So who wrote this?
That was me.
Can you stop saying, I feel like I have to advocate for our dear listeners. Can you stop saying who wrote this without like saying what it is? Because it's not just like showing something to the camera and saying, look at this, dear listeners, isn't it great? It's also like highlighting something in a document that's private to us and hoping that the listeners will be able to understand the context.
Alex, you have to understand, there's no possible way for me to work the husbands and wives show into this episode. So I need to make in-jokes somehow.
Macy, once again, dear listeners, Macy is referring to Person of Interest, a very good show, the Husbands and Wives show.
The cost of power and the cost of peace to the individual is a topic which Freya would like to elucidate now. Thank you, please.
Thank you. Yes. So the dot point, which is being invisibly highlighted for your pleasure, is, as Macy said, The Deadly Education has a lot to say about what the cost of magic and power is, both to the individual and to a magical society. And that is what I wanted to ask Naomi to talk about a little bit, because this book is doing some really interesting things with how an individual generates power and what the cost is to them, but also What is the cost of having magical people, and how is the cost paid by the Scholomance?
Right. And, you know, it's one of those things where very often ideas that I explore in fanfic, because, of course, the wonderful thing about fanfic is fanfic does not have to be a commercial mm-hmm. length. It does not have to be, I don't have to necessarily build a whole world from scratch.
Plot.
I can go with the characters who live inside my yep. head already. And so I often find myself exploring ideas in fanfic that then end up in my next book, which then doesn't get published for uh-huh. 2 years. Because that's the
that's
schedule.
How it goes.
Right. And, you know, one of the things for me when I was writing Victory mm-hmm. Condition is just this sort of really palpable sense of that the way in which much of the evil that we do as both as individuals and as a society is predicated on hiding it right. from ourselves, right? It's all the systems that we have, the systems fundamentally of capitalism, right? That the systems are all designed and become increasingly more efficient at moving harm, moving costs away from the visibility of the people who are essentially propelling the doing, you know, creating the propulsive force. And so that you have this kind of propulsive force happening back here that by the time it gets to the people who are actually being right. hit, it can't be stopped.
And also it can be plausibly denied that it was done on purpose.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Exactly. That sort of plausible deniability. And in a way, you know, Victory Condition, and I don't know that I would have said this mm-hmm. at the time, but I think about it in retrospect, that it's about essentially the, you know, that I think that what Omelas, the city mm-hmm. of Omelas, and I think that one of the problems with a lot of times when people read Omelas, they get to the child and they think Omelas is this horrible mm-hmm. place. And that's, they have missed the huge front loading of Omelas is amazing, mm-hmm. right? And the contrast that Omelas is a place where there is one yeah. child in one basement, as opposed to our world in which there are millions of children in millions yeah. of basements. Yeah. And that I feel that the distinction of Omelas, right, is that Omelas is the place, it's the Empire of Unsheathed Knives, it's the place where you right. look at right. your own cruelty and you don't deny mm-hmm. it and you face and you look at it. You force yourself to tell the truth. You force yourself to look at the harm you do. And that, you know, obviously, you know, this is not necessarily relevant to giant robots, but if you're a person, right, then all our natural instincts of non-broken people, and there are broken people, but there are, you know, people who are sociopathic or narcissistic or who literally cannot experience the feelings of others. But for the vast majority of people, it is very hard to deliberately cause harm and knowingly do something truly horrible if it isn't kind of hidden from, if you haven't sort of bought yep. into hiding mm-hmm. it from
there's
yourself.
Hiding or justifying, like, can I convince myself this person is evil?
Right, right, which is, of course, and even then, you've got to have that person far enough away that you can't, that they can yep. blur, you know, that soft yep. focus, evil, mm-hmm. evil cloud, yes. As opposed to if they're right in front of you, talking to you, you know, in pain or crying. You know, if you see somebody who, like, gets hit by a car in the street in front of you, don't stop to say, like, are you a good person? Let's quiz before you, like, you know, put a tourniquet on or whatever. So the question is, so walking away from Omelas, I feel, is predicated on being in Omelas. And to walk away, you have to say, I'm going to love also. I am going to choose to open my horizons of the people that I'm willing to care about. Because if you look at, right, because that's the piece, is first telling the truth about your own cruelty and saying, I'm willing to sort of, in a way, face what I'm really doing and recognize the harm that I'm doing. That could potentially still lead to enormous cruelty, right? That's what Omelas is doing. They are deliberately choosing to hurt this one child in order to preserve the rest. They are, and the, you know, that's sort of Optimus, yeah, right, is the one who says, I'm going to love that child even if it costs me.
Yeah.
So, but you can't really choose that if you're not also, if you haven't basically actually first started by looking at
it. I think that that was the thing that I was looking at with, oh gosh, the girl from the upper class group, Orion's friend.
Chloe.
Right, that was the journey kind of that I saw her going on, right? Was her discovery of what was actually happening, what she taught herself not to see. Because basically in A Deadly Education, you are much less likely to die if you came in with certain advantages. And so the kids who have those certain advantages kind of turn their faces away from the suffering of the others. And it's kind of expected and allowed. And Elle sort of rubs their nose in it.
Right. And I wish that I had written down the line where it happened. But like, I read this one line from Elle and I was like, oh, this is your victory condition moment, Elle. This is like your Megatron moment where you're like, fuck the system, actually. Let's just like... tear it down.
Let's just save everyone.
Let's just save everyone because that's something that we can do. So yeah, fantastic.
I've been thinking about how this interacts with Harry Potter because I think a lot of what there's conversations that have happened in Harry Potter fandom and in fanfic have been to do with the idea that as a book series and as a narrative, especially the first book, it tries to hide the knives. Because what we're doing is we are taking a child who is living in a cupboard and we are taking him out of that and we're putting him somewhere safe and protected.
We're
and from
feeding
his point
him
of
pumpkin
view,
pie. And
from his point of view, he has now been protected and taken out of this, you know, terrible situation that he was in, put in a place where he has all the food he could want and friends. But on a certain level, he is still the sacrifice. It is
he doesn't get to see the
veil. He is still the sacrifice that is being... that fattened Dumbledore the and the magical adults in the magical world are saying, this is the chosen one, this is the one that we are prepared to sacrifice in order to be safe again. But he doesn't see that because from his point of view, he was the child who has now been saved. He was the child who lives, he's now been saved, and he doesn't know what he is being prepared for.
It's and I think this is why I hate, I have a real grudge against chosen one narratives where it's a prophecy or something that's pinned to an individual kid. As opposed to the heroes like Alana the Lioness, where they choose, right? Because you're just completely removing agency. You're making this sacrificial, you're putting this on a character. And what does that say to a reader, right? Like, what does it say about what you have to endure if it's for the best for all? Like, I don't want to teach kids that it's good to stay in an abusive situation, frankly.
So that is the end of the episode. Thank you so much, Naomi, for coming on to join us.
Yes,
your book is wonderful. I hope it goes amazingly well. Dear listeners, you should go buy it.
Thank you.
A Deadly Education, which just came out on September 29th, or will have just come out for you.
There we go.
For us, that's still in the future.
Yes. Thank you all for having me. This was so much fun.
Thank you.
Hello everybody, thanks for joining us for this episode of Be the Serpent, a podcast of extremely, extremely deep literary merit. I'm recording this outro on October the 4th, when the words "everything happens so much" have never been more appropriate. Like Elle, we're all engaged in survival mode this year, and I don't really know what to say except to hope that this episode, and Naomi's fantastic book, can provide you with some sustenance and some distraction. I've seen a lot of our listeners tweeting about which episodes they're listening to and how they're helping them get through lockdown, and we are incredibly glad to be providing that small service of making art and making ourselves laugh in the midst of the darkness. And speaking of darkness, hey, for the next episode, 2 weeks hence, on October 21st, we'll be doing our bit to prepare you for the spooky season, because we're talking about vampires. Or, as Alex is going to try to insist we pronounce it, vampires. So, if you've got any friends who are mysteriously unaging, or really into hot people who sizzle in the sunlight, maybe give them a heads up. One of our tentpoles will be Taika Waititi's film What We Do in the Shadows, which I highly recommend you check out. Questions? Comments? Breathless adulations? As ever, you can get in touch with us at serpentcast@gmail.com, and we're at serpentcast on Twitter and Tumblr. Or come and join the fan Discord community, which is linked on the About the Show page of the podcast website. If you have been enjoying the podcast and would like to support us more, you can find our Patreon at patreon.com/serpentcast. Or please consider leaving us a rating and review on iTunes so we can continue to reach new listeners. And by the way, the Void approves of you, and we do too.